Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. This week, lawmakers debated legislation that would push back on the Supreme Court's Wayfair decision and failed to pass a bill of substance. Senator Jean Shaheen criticizes what she calls the president's Twitter diplomacy, and potential 2020 presidential candidates make a few notable appearances in New Hampshire. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we're also streaming a live video of this radio program today, so you can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here.
Hey, Peter.
And Dean, welcome back. You were away in Europe and various countries for about a month, right?
Been away for a month. Been traveling for several weeks. Yep,
wow.
Far and wide. So glad
well,
to be
we
back.
Missed you. So thank you very much for
coming
on back. So interesting week this week. Made more interesting, I think, by the special session that the governor called for when the Supreme Court ruled on the so-called Wayfair decision, which would break decades of precedent and force some New Hampshire businesses selling goods online to collect sales tax on behalf of other states. Governor Sununu vowed to fight back, and the first part of that fight was to call lawmakers back to Concord for a special session to find some kind of legislative solution. That session happened this week. Lawmakers passed a study committee, but that's basically it. Paul, what happened?
Yeah, things were on track for quite some time. Last week, there was a special task force, a special bipartisan committee that put this bill together that would kind of put up roadblocks to slow down other states from trying to collect that online sales tax from New Hampshire businesses that sell their goods on the internet. So going into this week, things looked pretty good. This looked like it was going to be a victory, a big victory for the governor just 3.5 months before he's up for re-election. And it was going to be a kind of a feel-good week, right, that New Hampshire was going to continue to protect its tax-free status. But then things went awry pretty quickly. On Tuesday, the New Hampshire Freedom Caucus, which is a very conservative, probably the most conservative group on the Republican side and the Republican majority in the House.
Tuesday, this was the day before the session was supposed to begin.
The day before the session, right. They raised issues. They had problems. And they told me that they reached out to the governor's office, his team, and said, we've got problems with this. Let's slow this process down. Then we get to the day, Wednesday, the day of the session. And this is where the trouble began. But at first, it was very smooth. The state Senate voted 24-0, unanimous vote in favor of this bill that was put together the previous week by a bipartisan group of legislature lawmakers. Then it gets to the House, and that's where it all fell apart, and it went down. It went down by a vote of, I think, 164 to 151, and you had these conservative Republicans, the Freedom Caucus members, they voted against it, as did about 85 Democrats, some of the more liberal members of the Democratic Caucus, and it was a big defeat. It was a lot of egg on the face for the governor and for the state Senate.
And State Senator Lou D'Alessandro expressed frustration after the House failed to pass this bill. Let's hear what he had to say.
To do what just happened across the street is an insult to the legislative process, and I find that very difficult to accept. We're equal bodies. We work hard for the benefit of the people of the state of New Hampshire. Then you take all of that work and you throw it aside and say, if it isn't my way, it's the highway. That's totally unacceptable.
So Paul Lou D'Alessandro saying insult to the legislative process.
And what was he talking about across the street, by the way? Just so people know, a little inside baseball, but the Senate chamber is being renovated right now. So the state Senate actually met across the street in the executive building. So here's what the House did. They basically took the Senate bill and they gutted it. They took everything out except to leave a study committee. So basically making this, you know, a shell of a bill. Why? Well, a lot of House lawmakers who voted against it said they had problems. They thought this was, A, being rushed. Probably, B, they didn't like the fact that they were getting a bill from the state Senate. And, you know, there's a lot of rivalry between the two chambers. Some thought it was unconstitutional. Others thought that if this was passed, it would maybe open up New Hampshire to liability, to lawsuits. So you had a combination of Democrats and Republicans opposing their leadership in the House and bringing this down. And to compound all this, well, the governor actually wasn't in the state at the time. The governor was in Colorado for most of this week. He was attending a long-planned Republican Governors Association meeting in Aspen, Colorado. He returned to the state on Wednesday afternoon after all this had happened, after traveling back from Colorado. But his office told me that he was in touch, you know, throughout the entire trip with his team here in New Hampshire. One of the top Republicans from the Freedom Caucus, J.R. Hole, the state rep from Dunbarton, I asked him specifically, I said, if the governor was here, do you think it would have made a difference? Would this have passed? Would he have changed minds? J.R. Hall said no. He said this bill was going to go down regardless. But the top two Democrats disagreed. The state Senate minority leader and the state House minority leader both said that the governor, if he had been here, he probably could have changed things.
Yeah, and before we get into the political implications for the governor, I wanted to ask Dean about the question of the legislative process and how this went down. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, this is interesting. Paul's essentially correct. There was some unhappiness with the rules of the special session, that some House members expressed displeasure, basically being given this Senate bill that was passed, I think, unanimously in the Senate and then onto the House. So they felt like they were a little bit politically constrained on this for the one-day special session. You know, this is going to take a while to unpack why things unfolded the way they did. And, you know, Democrats have seized, as Paul mentioned, on the fact that Sununu was out of town for most of this. My guess is he probably thought things were going to move along pretty smoothly given the way it had progressed thus far, even though it sounds like there were some warning signs on Tuesday. And, you know, this reminds me a little bit of those circumstances where a mayor or a governor is out of town and there's a big snowstorm and snow removal doesn't go so well and kind of catches everybody off guard. Now, his advisors have said that he was in touch regularly with what was going on in the House and Senate. But this is one of those interesting occasions where you have a temporary alliance between liberals and conservatives. As Paul mentioned, some conservatives thought it was toothless. It didn't go far enough. Other conservatives were concerned about the constitutionality, given the U.S. Congress and the Commerce Clause that governs these kinds of things. And the Democrats, there was another set of issues with Medicaid, the switch in expanded Medicaid to managed care and additional money, I think $7.5 million for mental health and substance abuse. They wanted that kind of folded in. They wanted another plank folded in about studying the impact of the Trump tariffs on New Hampshire. So, you know, Democrats had their own agenda as well, and just the combination of the two seemed to tank the whole thing. And I think it was a surprise. My guess is it was a surprise to Governor Sununu. I'm not sure why they settled on the timing that they did, given that he was going to be out of town if this was, in fact, a long-scheduled RGA meeting. It's a little bit of sort of insider baseball, but it is, at least in the short term, something that Sununu is going to have to deal with.
So, and Governor Sununu did respond to criticism that he hadn't worked hard enough this week on this bill, responding to criticism that, you know, he was out of state at the time. But here's what he had to say.
Look, the point is that they had a good bill in front of them. They got to close the deal and get it done for the citizens of this state. So I hope they come back. I hope they take it up again. It's too important of an issue just to let to sit on the sidelines and hope for the best.
So Governor Sununu hoping that the lawmakers reconsider. Senate President Chuck Morse said that he does want to ask lawmakers to try this again.
Yeah, and they'll be back in September again for some other business. And so there's the hope by, you know, Morse and by the governor and by people who want to get this done that it can be done, get done a little later this year. Who, you know, listen, as much as the Democrat, we're as I said, we're 3.5 months out now from the general election when the governor's up for another 2-year term in the corner office. So Molly Kelly, the and Steve Marchand, the two Democratic candidates, were quick to criticize the governor, saying he was basically, you know, out of sight, out of mind, and being an absent governor. And you know, this. It gives them, the governor gave them some ammunition to use here. He was out of the state. At the same time, I think, you know, it also shows the lack of leadership by the House majority leadership. The House Republicans have had a problem all session. I mean, this was a high-profile defeat, but remember, we also had the educational savings accounts, which were backed by the governor and by a lot of Republicans. They went down. Marcy's Law, here's another big defeat earlier this year where things got through the Senate. Couldn't get through the House.
Well, it also shows the difficulty of corralling a 400-person legislative chamber at any given moment. It can catch you by surprise. You know, there's something to be said for taking some time to figure this out. This is all driven by the Wayfair decision, which is a Supreme Court decision. So anything that the state legislature does, and some members of the House express this concern, could be subject to further constitutional scrutiny. So that's one reason why they wanted a study committee, so that they can kind of look at this more carefully. But this is one of those things where you get this unusual alliance between left and right, and it was enough to sink the bill.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you on both the Wayfair decision and the attempt by lawmakers this week to sort of slow down the impact in New Hampshire. Are you a business owner who sells something online who, because of the Wayfair decision, might have to collect sales tax on behalf of other states? If so, give us a call. Let us know your perspective. We'd love to hear from you. Would it be a huge burden to you to have to collect these taxes on behalf of other jurisdictions? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Perhaps you have something to say about the governor's performance this week with respect to this bill fighting the Wayfair decision. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Dean, you just mentioned, you know, the difficulty in corralling 400 lawmakers, more than 400 lawmakers, into one place in an ordinary time. Now a special session. Paul, what did lawmaker attendance make a difference here?
Yeah, it definitely did. Look at the vote in the Senate, 24-0. There's 24 state senators in that chamber. They were all there. That's not the problem. The problem is the House. Again, there's 400 members. It's the largest legislative body, state body in the country. The
About
vote was one.
It was like 160 or like 150, roughly.
There were 315 people attended, or 315 people voted on the bill. That's what, I'm doing the math, 85? That's a huge number of
summer.
People.
People are on vacation,
yes,
I suppose.
Granted, but it's been an issue all this legislative session.
It
was just magnified this time around. But yeah, it made a difference. It made a big difference.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Jerry Knurick in Freedom. Jerry, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yes, hi. I'm one of the state representatives, and I was calling because there are a few things that were said that were not exactly accurate. What happened in the, the Senate passed it unanimously. When it went to the House, there was an amendment that was passed with the vote 164-151. That did strip out essentially all the legislation, but did keep the commission to study it. Then that amended bill was passed by the full House at 258-57. When it went back to the Senate, they did not concur, and that's why it essentially died, because they did not want to concur with just what the House had done. But it wasn't going to make it totally toothless. What many people objected to was that this process was rather rushed, with a task force working over about 3 days to come up with this legislation, coming in through the Senate, a lot of rules that did not allow very much change to it or anything. And the point is that it was not that much of an emergency that it couldn't go through a more deliberative process like many bills do. And so many people voted against it because they felt it was being rushed. And it's just that many people also voted against because they felt it might not pass constitutional muster and get us into a lot of lawsuits that would cost a lot of money. So it really didn't make it a useless bill, what the House did. It made it a bill that was going to still study it and try to come up with some legislation that might be a bit better, but do it more in this kind of process that we might normally do, to be a little slower and more deliberative.
And Representative Knurick, can I ask what your view of the Wayfair decision is?
Well, I think it's complicated. As it was said earlier, I think, by one of the guests, that there's going to be a lot more work that's going to be done as remanded to the South Dakota Supreme Court to do some more work. I think we don't really know exactly where it's going to land. I think it is a difficult problem, and we certainly don't want to give up our advantage in terms of the sales tax. But we also that we have to follow what the Supreme Court says. We can't really just thumb our nose at a ruling of theirs. So I think that we have a lot of work to do to try to figure out how we can make things work, but just to try to erect a bunch of barriers that may not be constitutional may not be one of their best options, I don't think.
Well, Representative Jerry Knirk, thank you very much for giving us a call and sharing your insights. So Jerry spells out the problem, Dean. There are constitutional concerns here.
Yeah, I mean, and he also laid out a useful technical point in that the House didn't simply kill the Senate bill. They amended it to strip everything out except for this study commission that I think was supposed to report back in some longer period of time. And then the Senate refused to accept that, rather significant amendment. So that was the kind of the legislative process. But as I mentioned, the issue here that some people have complained about is that you're dealing with a Supreme Court decision. Anything you do legislatively, and this is true for the U.S. Congress as well, there is judicial review. You have to be careful about how you deal with the constitutionality of what you're doing. And so, some people say that means you have to take a little bit more deliberate approach rather than try to patch something together in 2 or 3 days.
Paul?
After the Wayfair decision by the Supreme Court late last month, there was widespread condemnation of that decision. There's bipartisan support, obviously, in the state that the Wayfair decision was bad for New Hampshire. What to do about it? That's a very different story, right? And that's what we saw play out this week. And again, a lot of lawmakers wanted to slow down the process, have hearings, do it in a more traditional way, and then when they come back in September, then maybe vote on it. Now it's kind of moot for now. We'll see if they can resurrect this. The other thing, remember, there's 5 states in our country that don't have a sales tax. I believe that New Hampshire was the only state to actually try to take action immediately in the wake of this Supreme Court decision. And for now, at least, it's blown up in their faces.
Well, Paul, since it's an election year, can I ask you an optics question? Because it seems like Governor Sununu has every incentive to fight this, mm-hmm. And ask lawmakers to do it and say, we're going to fight this tooth and nail. But if lawmakers fail to come up with something, Governor Sununu essentially can still take a politically, I guess, savvy position and say, well, I still want to fight this.
Yeah, and he's trying to defend New Hampshire's tax-free status, right? So, yeah, I mean, which is a very popular position here in New Hampshire, of course. So, yeah, I think it's debatable how much this hurts him. He's got very good poll numbers right now, but the Democrats will use this, and we've seen it just in the last 24 hours, they'll use this incident, this failure, against him.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And still to come on the Roundup, we will be talking about the ACA. A mother whose son relies heavily on the healthcare system for his survival is worried about the president's weakening of the Affordable Care Act. Paul, you've done some reporting on that. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Senator Jeanne Shaheen's criticism of the president's rhetoric on Twitter with respect to Iran. Listeners, if you have questions about the week's news, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send your comments by email, exchange@nhpr.org.
Partly to mostly cloudy for today. Chances of some afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Some of the storms could have gusty winds and heavy rainfall. High temperatures mid to upper 80s. It'll be mostly cloudy tonight. Chance of showers and thunderstorms again. Some of the storms could have gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Low temperatures tonight in the 60s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers. High temperatures lower 80s. And mostly sunny Sunday. Highs upper 70s to lower 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit specializing in college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org. And from North Branch Construction, celebrating 60 years in business, on time, on budget, online at northbranch.net. This is NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with political reporter Paul Steinhauser and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, we'd love to hear your questions or comments about the week's news. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're broadcasting a live video of this radio program today. You can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Let's start this part of the program talking about, Paul, a story that you were covering. You reported on a mother whose son relies heavily on the healthcare system for his survival, who's worried about the weakening of the Affordable Care Act. So tell us about this family and what they're hoping to achieve.
Yeah, the boy, who's now 4 years old, he suffers from a rare neuromuscular disease. He kind of atrophies the muscles, and it impedes his mobility. He got it when he was about a year old. His name is Bodhi Bhattarai, I believe, and he lives here in Concord in the Heights on the east side. Because of the Affordable Care Act, his parents say, he is able to survive. He has a very expensive wheelchair that gives him mobility. Without the Affordable Care Act, he would be in serious, serious trouble. He's been in the news quite some time. Senator Shaheen talked about him on the floor of the U.S. Senate last year when the Republicans were trying to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. Senator Hassan had an event at his house as well, highlighting his struggles. So the two senators now came to Concord on Monday, and they had an event at the Riverbend Community Mental Health where they were highlighting the Republican attempts, the administration's attempts to try to weaken the Affordable Care Act. They kind of highlighted how the Justice Department is no longer defending the Affordable Care Act in courts. And they said,
which is a big deal that we haven't heard much about in the news.
It's definitely been overshadowed by some other stories that have nationally been getting a lot more headlines. But yeah, it is a very big deal. And, you know, what they did at this event was they brought in a bunch of people like Bodhi's mother to talk about how if the Affordable Care Act goes away or is even further weakened, it would, A, result in maybe the coverage or the protections for people with pre-existing conditions going away, which would be very dramatic. And they talked about the rise in premiums. They talked about the rise in prescription drug prices. And we got some personal stories from people on how this would affect them and their families and their health.
Dean, what do you think? Where's the Affordable Care Act now in terms of future policy changes?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly has dropped from the headlines in comparison to early in Trump's presidency when there was an attempt by the administration and by Republicans in Congress to repeal and replace the ACA. As Paul mentioned, the big issue here is a decision by the Trump administration to no longer defend the ACA in court. The provisions of the ACA have been challenged in court pretty much continuously since the act was passed. Now we know that all presidential administrations prioritize what their departments of justice do based on ideological considerations and political considerations. All presidents do that, but the reality is when President Obama was in office, the Department of Justice would defend these lawsuits against Obamacare. You know, the big concern here is the pre-existing conditions. You know, in my mind, that's a third rail for Republicans. If they start tinkering with pre-existing conditions and you hear these heartrending stories around the country of people whose families depend on it, that's going to be a problem for them, much in the same way that the attempts to repeal or reduce Medicaid really scuttled the early attempts to repeal and replace the ACA under Trump. So a lot of political considerations here. It's been out of the headlines, but you're hearing Democrats around the country talk about it on the campaign trail. They believe that this is an important issue for them, particularly if the administration starts tinkering with the pre-existing conditions clause. Trump has said he wouldn't. It's very popular, but you never know what's going to happen on the ground in the different congressional districts.
Paul?
Remember last year, Republicans in Congress and the White House tried to repeal and replace Obamacare, and that failed. The legislative attempt failed. So the administration, trying to, you know, follow through on its campaign pledge from the 2016 election, has been taking these actions, the Justice Department action, other executive orders to weaken the law. Our two senators here in New Hampshire, both Democrats, obviously, Hassan and Shaheen, have been huge defenders of the law. And they've had a number of events. This was the first one in a while, though, where they really showcased their battle to try to protect the law. And their message was, we need help. We need everybody who supports Obamacare to get involved in this fight. We'll see what happens.
To what extent, Paul, has this been an issue on the campaign trail this year?
Democrats bring up health care a lot.
It is an issue
you hear from Democrats as they try to retake the U.S. House of Representatives, as they try to, you know, retake the chambers here in the State House. But you don't hear a lot about it from Republicans.
And that's always, that's pretty much always been the case. Democrats, this has been just a more high priority issue on their political agenda. Republicans have been kind of focused on other issues, but it's certainly out there, I think, on the campaign trail. And, you know, much in the same way that we heard lots of stories about the impact of a reduction in Medicaid funding under these attempts to repeal and replace, I think if they start to tinker with the pre-existing conditions, you're going to hear a lot more stories like this one where people mobilize as a result.
And the exchange will be discussing the Affordable Care Act on Monday, how the law has been affected or may be affected by the Trump administration's actions. We'll be speaking with Deputy Commissioner Alex Feldwebel, Deputy Commissioner with the State Insurance Department, and Julie Robner, Chief Washington Correspondent with Kaiser Health News. That's Monday at 9 on The Exchange. Paul?
And that's going to be a great discussion, because guess what's going to happen in the next few months? We're going to see the rates and how much they're going to increase for next year. That's going to be coming very soon, and that's going to be another big sticker price shocker.
Listeners, call into The Exchange with your questions or comments about the week's news. Phone number is 1-800-892-6477. If you'd rather not call, you can send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Also this week, Senator Jean Shaheen said Iran is a clear threat to the United States, but she criticized President Donald Trump for tweeting about it. Here's what Senator Jean Shaheen had to say.
Foreign policy by tweet is not the way to make foreign policy. And what we need is for the president to consult with his foreign policy team, with Secretary Pompeo, with Secretary Mattis, with the other foreign policy leaders, and come up with a strategy for how to respond to Iran, as opposed to tweets that aggravate the situation.
So, Paul, this was your conversation with Senator Jean Shaheen. What prompted this? What's the story behind it?
That was Monday morning at that same healthcare event that we were just talking about. The night before, pretty late on Sunday night, at least Eastern Standard Time or Eastern Daylight Savings Time, the president tweeted in all caps, "Never, ever threaten the United States again." He was directing this towards the Iranian president, "or you will suffer consequences the like of which few throughout history have ever suffered before," again, in all caps. So a sense of urgency here, this threat coming from the president. So there was a lot of reaction. Of course, we talked to Shaheen because she sits not only on the Foreign Services Committee, but also on the Armed Services Committee. And she's one of the top Democrats in the country when it comes to foreign relations. There was a lot of pushback by Democrats, as you can imagine, to the president's statement saying, listen, Iran, yes, is a threat, but this is not the way to handle diplomacy.
And Iran didn't really seem troubled at all by the president's tweet, as far as I remember, right?
There was some pushback from the Iranian president, but yeah, they basically said you're playing with fire.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about 2020, because it's never too soon to talk about 2020. And people are either visiting or planning to visit, including Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who you spoke to, was it just last night,
just
Paul?
Last night. So the Colorado governor is somebody that everybody's been keeping their eyes on. He's term limited. He's had two terms. Now he's finishing up his second term in Colorado. Fascinating guy. He was a trained geologist out of college, became a brewpub pioneer in Denver. Then as a first-time candidate, he won election as mayor of Denver, served two terms, then now two terms as governor of Colorado. And I didn't realize this, every year he takes a vacation, a family vacation, since he was a little boy in Squam Lake, just north of Winnipesaukee here in the Lakes region. But he took a little time out from that vacation yesterday to do some political stuff, and that's what's sparking national speculation about his possibility of running in 2020 for the Democratic presidential nomination. He met with the New Hampshire Young Democrats earlier in the evening, and then he was in Exeter, and that's where I had a chance to meet with him. He helped the New Hampshire Democratic Party open up their newest coordinated campaign field office, this one in Exeter. And I had a chance to chat with him about, you know, a lot of things, including what he thinks about running for president. He said he will definitely make a decision after he finishes up his term in Colorado, so that would be early next year. But he also made a little news saying that he is very seriously considering this fall setting up either a exploratory committee or maybe a leadership pack, which would allow him to travel around the country and think about running for president. He said that while on this vacation, him and his family are talking about that. That's a very serious step to take. He's, you know, Peter, he's known more as a centrist and as a pragmatist rather than as a progressive. So I asked him, how's that going to play here in New Hampshire if you decide to run? Because this is the state, of course, where Bernie Sanders trounced Hillary Clinton in the primary back in 2016. And he said, we'll see. But he said that he's been somebody that's been pretty good over the years at bringing all the different factions of the Democratic Party together at least in his home state of Colorado.
Yeah. Hickenlooper is someone who pretty much since Trump was elected president, every time I see him on a Sunday morning chat show, he's being asked about whether or not he's going to run for president. So he's used to the speculation at this point, I think. And Paul mentioned exploratory committees and leadership PACs. We've seen an interesting change in how people run for president. In the old days, you'd have the invisible primary in which people are kind of up here sort of feeling out the potential for a presidential run, and then they form an exploratory committee, and then they eventually declare for the presidency. What we saw in 2016 was increasingly, and Jeb Bush was kind of the paradigm of this, is you set up a leadership PAC because it allows you to raise a lot of money, and you hold off declaring presidential intentions as long as possible. You don't even really set up an exploratory committee because you can keep raising money. And, you know, the reason why a lot of these folks are coming here now, the midterm election allows them an opportunity to get involved in political organizations in the state, to make connections, to get a sense of who the key political operatives are. So you increasingly see members of Congress and governors and others coming to New Hampshire saying they're going to help out in the midterm elections. And it's really a way to make connections and collect IOUs for a potential presidential run.
Other notable visits planned for later this summer and early fall. Congressman Seth Moulton is coming to New Hampshire to headline an event for Maura Sullivan.
Yeah, he's got a very interesting backstory. He's a former Marine Corps officer. Did four tours in Iraq. Was here campaigning for Maura Sullivan, also a former Marine. He's only 39. I think there's no rush for him, but he's certainly nothing to be lost from kind of getting up here and checking out the waters.
He's been very clear in interviews. I remember when I spoke to him last fall when he was up here last time before this recent trip, and he said, "No, I'm not running. I have no desire to run for the White House." But nobody believes him on that one. And now these are two trips within a week, right? Last week he was here to campaign for Maura Sullivan, a fellow Marine who also served in the Iraq War. She, of course, is running in the 1st Congressional District, one of 11 Democrats running to try to succeed Carol Shea Porter, who's retiring. And now he's back this weekend to headline an event with the Merrimack County Democrats. So two trips in 1 week, that's sparking a lot of speculation. But you're right, that's just one of a bunch of others who are coming, right?
I think the most interesting one, though, is Montana Governor Steve Bullock.
Coming in August.
Yeah, I think most people probably couldn't tell you who the governor of Montana is, but he's a 52-year-old Democrat. He's the chairman of the National Governors Association, which is a bipartisan organization of governors. It's different than the Democratic Governors or the Republican Governors Associations. Chris Sununu was at, I think, the Republican Governors Association mm-hmm. meeting in Colorado. So this is the larger bipartisan organization. It's always a great platform from which governors test the waters for a presidential run. So this is interesting. You know, we're seeing a couple folks here who are not the sort of usual suspects here in New Hampshire early on. I think, you know, I've talked with a number of people. It's going to be a massive list of people running for president on the Democratic side in 2020. You know, easily going to match what we saw with the Republicans in 2016.
And, of course, worth mentioning Representative Adam Schiff of California headlining a Portsmouth Democrats annual banquet event on September 28th.
Yep, I broke that one the other day. And interesting because Schiff has gotten a lot of attention. He's the top Democrat, as you said, on the House Intelligence Committee, which, of course, is investigating the Russia probe, right? So he's been on CNN and MSNBC.
He's a fixture on those channels.
Yes.
He's on all the time.
And there's a lot of people who would probably like to see him run because of his height and stature and because of the way he's been forcibly taking on the House Republicans on that committee who are very much in support of the president. Listen, all this stuff is all the pregame show, but Peter, we're just 3.5 months away from the actual start of the race for the White House. The day after the midterms, the race begins.
That's when it really begins.
After lunch. I always talk about the midterms in the morning, and then after lunch the next day, we start talking about the presidential race.
All right, mark your calendars, everybody. That's when it's going to start. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with our guests today about the week's news. Coming up after the break, we will talk about SB 3, some students hoping to challenge the law. We're told that they do not have standing to do so. We'll look at why, and we'll look at what's next for the challenge for SB 3. Give us a call if you have questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here with Dean Spiliotis of SNHU and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Give us a call to join the conversation about the week's news. Ask questions, make comments. The number is 1-800-892-6477. 6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or watch the live video stream of this radio program at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So let's talk about SB 3. It was in the news this week because six college students who were trying to challenge SB 3 on the grounds that it was disenfranchising college students, state said those students don't have standing to do so because it seems like they still have the right to vote. Paul, is that your understanding of the story?
I believe that is exactly the way it played out. But Dean, I'm going to defer to you on this one.
No, it was a very straightforward argument that they can't claim that they've been harmed because they were able to register and legally vote. Yeah, SB 3, we've been kind of preoccupied recently with the whole residency issue and the impact on college students of the legislation that Governor Sununu just signed, that we've kind of forgotten that SB 3 has been in the courts for a while now. This is the one that would levy very heavy fines if you don't provide proof of your ability to vote in a particular town. And there had been some concern about, you know, should clerks be responsible for that or law enforcement? You know, who follows up? The state attorney general? All of that has ended up in court. In 2016, I think a judge let the law go forward, but without the ability to enact any of the stiff penalties. So that's all winding its way through court. There's a lawsuit that was filed by the League of Women Voters and the New Hampshire Democratic Party, saying that SB 3 hurts Democrats more than Republicans and suppresses the vote. And that's the genesis of why this keeps popping up periodically in the courts.
Yeah, the courts, the judge still has to sort of weigh in on whether the students have standing. But so far some have said they don't. Some of them have New Hampshire driver's licenses already. Two of them, I believe, have voted since filing this complaint here. So that's still got to work its way through the courts. But and you mentioned the League of Women Voters. I mean, they were arguing to have some folks deposed so that they could talk about how this law came to be. Republican state representatives Kathleen Holzel and Barbara Griffin, along with GOP state senator Regina Birdsell, they will not be required to submit depositions. But why would their depositions have been significant?
Well, I mean, I guess the issue is to get a sense of the legislative intent. You know, was this legislation designed to suppress votes or to hurt Democrats, or, you know, what was kind of legislative intent? Although they are, I believe that the judge said that they could depose the two lawyers who have been involved in the litigation and in advising officials about the impact of SB 3. You know, there was also a discussion at one point about whether or not the parties could have access to voter data in order to be able to demonstrate empirically that this is a harmful piece of legislation. So, you know, what comes out of this, I think we're still at the Superior Court level, if I'm correct. You know, what comes out of this, I think, will feed into this larger debate about voter suppression and residency and your ability to vote in your town.
Paul? And that's where I was going to go, because I always like to bring it back to the campaign trail, right? That's my job as a campaign reporter. This is another issue where Democrats are going to have been talking a lot and will continue to talk a lot about, both SB 3 and the voter eligibility bill that the governor signed just a few weeks ago. Are two issues that motivate Democrats, and it gets them out and excites them and energizes them, their opposition to both of these laws. The flip side, though, is that it's also an issue that motivates Republicans. A lot of conservatives in the state have long said that the Democrats have been trying to game the system, bringing these out-of-state voters into New Hampshire to vote using same-day registration. So it's an issue that motivates both sides, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out come November.
And there is a big there's been a long time concern among Republicans about college students. You know, you look at any election here in New Hampshire in recent years, and, you know, Hanover and Plymouth and Durham and any place where there are big concentrations of students, you typically get a large Democratic vote.
Okay, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Give us a call if you've got questions or comments about this SB 3 issue or about anything else in the week's news this week. 1-800-892-6477. One of these things that we covered a month ago, and it happened again, I guess, the Honeymoon Bridge in Jackson was damaged again. This is the bridge that appears in a lot of backgrounds on engagement photos, wedding photos. Couples write their names on the inside of this bridge. Pictures online show a damaged structural support and the entrance. Like, looks like a truck that was too big for it.
It was a concrete truck, I believe. I think it was twice in a week that it got damaged.
Wow. Yeah. And then, but this is like, it's sad because it's kind of a landmark, but it also has practical implications for folks who live there. Right?
Yeah, there's been some interesting reporting on this. You know, you think it's kind of an amusing story, but the reality is this bridge, particular bridge, is a central entrance into the village of Jackson, and it has real economic impact. I saw some reporting interviewing, you know, small business people. This is a big tourist season. When that bridge is closed for repairs, their business just drops through the floor. So there's real concern about. I think it's open now, but it's going to have to be closed again for some additional repairs. I think there was another covered bridge down, and maybe it was down in western New Hampshire, where it was also hit by a truck. So this is something you don't think about, but it is an occupational hazard trying to get delivery trucks and other trucks through these covered bridges.
Yeah, and I better watch out because I'm taking the kids to Storyland this weekend, I think, and that's just not too far. That's right. Just right over the border from Jackson. So, you know.
I thought you were going to weigh in with some kind of political implication.
No, I don't have anything either.
They can't campaign on the other side of the bridge anymore.
Peter, am I that predictable?
But I actually do have one more thing to say in terms of campaign, which is that the race for the first series, which has been going on since about 2014, is concluding on Monday on the Exchange.
Who do you got? Who's
the final candidate to speak to as part of the series is Democrat Paul Cardinal. You can hear that and watch it on Facebook Live starting at 9:40 a.m. on Monday, and you can send your questions to Paul Cardinal to exchange at nhpr.org. So that's the last political announcement that I had. Paul, did you want to say
he's something? Interesting because he's one of the two guys that got into the campaign at the very last minute. He filed in mid-June. We had 9 Democrats at the time. We thought that 9 was plenty, but now there are 11, and Cardinal was one of the two that filed at the very, very end. So I'm glad you're getting him in. And there was some other news on the Republican side this week, actually some big news. Rudy Giuliani, the former New York City mayor, America's mayor after 9/11, he was a 2008 Republican presidential candidate, and right now, of course, is the high-profile attorney and TV surrogate for the President Trump. He's coming up here next week. He'll be in Portsmouth next Wednesday to endorse Eddie Edwards in the battle for the Republican nomination in the 1st District. So kind of some interesting doings there on the Republican side of that big race.
Eddie Edwards has been lining up a number of endorsements.
A lot of endorsements,
and
yep.
You know, Trump is, for whatever you think of Trump, Trump is very popular among Republicans, and Giuliani is really his sort of big spokesman on TV right now.
Though Andy Sanborn, the other major Republican in the race, pointed out that he was endorsed by Corey Lewandowski, of course, a Windham, New Hampshire resident, and he, of course, remains tight with the president. He was the president's first campaign manager way back in 2015 and 2016. So we'll see. Do endorsements really matter? Probably not, but we talk about them.
Well, Dean, I wanted to ask you about President Trump and his popularity overseas, because you did a brief tour of Europe this month. You were there when the president had his press conference with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. What kind of conversations did you have with people while you were overseas?
Yeah, it was fascinating. I did something I've wanted to do for many years, which was I flew to Germany, rented a car, and basically spent 2 weeks driving around Central Europe, Austria, Hungary, the former Czechoslovakia. Beautiful country out there. Vienna, Budapest, Bratislava, Munich, fascinating cities. It was in the context, obviously not intentionally, just scheduling with the Helsinki summit. All of these countries are dealing with their own immigration crises, refugee crises. We're seeing the rise of nationalism and populism on the right. You have Orban in Hungary. Angela Merkel in Germany has been dealing with pressure from the right wing politicians in Germany. So a lot of people sort of very interested in Trump on both sides. A lot of people, as soon as they heard I was from New Hampshire, wanted to talk about the New Hampshire primary. So we are known internationally, but just kind of a lot of concern about, you know, sort of the consistency of Trump's foreign policy. Where is he headed? How does the world deal with this immigration and refugee crisis and rise of right wing populism that we're seeing really all over Europe?
Well, Dean, we're glad to have you stateside again. Thanks very much for coming back
to
the show
today.
And thanks to you, Paul Steinhauser, for being here and sharing your insights and all your reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Listeners, links to the stories that we've talked about today are online, nhpr.org. You can check them out there. Consider the news successfully rounded up for the week, but the conversation continues at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. That's also where you can check out the video of this program. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and our intern is Abby Sleeper. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much. very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.